Chapter 2. The next evening, Thorne and Amanda pulled up to the ranch house of Mason and Grace, at the south end of Colson, bundled in their two-seater rig. Mason met them at the front porch. "You two look as cute as a couple of snowshoe hares. Amanda, why don't you get inside and warm up while Thorne and I get your rig in the barn?" "That's a fair deal," Amanda said. Mason helped her out of the rig. "Grace is in the kitchen. Just help yourself inside." Amanda went indoors while Thorne took his horse by the bridle and led it into Mason's hay barn. Mason walked beside him. "Grace fixed your favorite meal, pot roast and mashed potatoes." "Ooh, she sure knows my weakness," Thorne said. Amanda called out to Grace as she walked in the front door. "Grace, we're here."
"I'm in the kitchen. Come on in."
Amanda followed the delightful smells coming from the kitchen and found Grace pulling biscuits out of the oven. "Those look pretty tempting. Anything I can do?"
"Well, if you wouldn't mind putting those biscuits in the basket, we're just about ready," Grace said.
And ready they were. The tablecloth featured a lovely checkerboard pattern and was set with china plates and a delicate silver setting, a wedding gift from Grace's papa, Grant Marsh. The pot roast waited to be carved as the boys hung up their coats and joined the ladies. Mason sat at the head of the table with the carving knife ready. "Thick cut or thin?" he asked Thorne. Thorne merely cocked his head and grinned. "I know. Why do I even ask?" May smiled as he cut a 1-inch thick slice of pot roast on the rare side. Conversation flowed easily. Mason and Thorne often caught themselves finishing each other's sentences. Grace and Amanda accepted their place in this sacred fellowship and honored their husband's need for time together. At the end of the meal, Mason turned to Grace. "Hope you girls will excuse Thorne and me. We got some work to talk over in the study." Amanda took this opportunity to bond with Grace. An elegant picture of Grant Marsh, Grace's father, proud in his steamboat uniform, hung in the dining room. At times throughout the meal, Amanda caught Grace glimpsing at the picture with a mixture of longing and admiration. "We've really haven't known each other for very long, but I can already sense that you and I are kindred spirits," Amanda confided.
"What do you mean?"
"We both hold our fathers in high regard, and we both embrace a healthy spirit of adventure. I know I got that from my father, and I expect you did too."
"Well, you're right," Grace said.
"My father raised me. I practically grew up on a steamboat."
"Well, you're singing my song," Amanda noted.
"My father built our ranch into the biggest spread in the county, and he taught me to ride a horse, shoot a gun, and split firewood."
"Say, can you keep a secret?" Grace asked with devilish delight.
"Oh, like a bear trap," Amanda replied as she slid closer to Grace to permit the exchange of confidences in hushed tones.
"My father once won an illegal steamboat race in St. Louis. I was 16 years old at the time, and I was on the ship when he did it."
"Illegal?" "Oh, yes, oh my. Steamboat racing has been illegal on the Mississippi for a long time. It's just too dangerous, what with boiler explosions and all."
"Oh, I see. Well, I don't know if Thorne ever mentioned that Grant Marsh set a steamboat speed record back in 1876 when he piloted the wounded survivors of Custer's massacre back from the Bighorn to Bismarck. 710 miles in 54 hours, an average of 13 miles an hour."
"No, I'm not sure he even knew. So?"
"Another well-known steamboat captain of the time, his name was John Cannon, previously held the speed record with an average of 12.8 miles per hour in a race from Natchez to St. Louis. He always scorned my father's 13-mile-an-hour run because it was all done downriver, where the current adds to your speed, because his run from Natchez to St. Louis was upriver, which of course slowed him down."
"Well, so what happened?"
"He never let my father live it down. He mocked him every chance he got. Finally, my father couldn't endure John Cannon's insults any longer. So in 1882, the two agreed to a secret race from Natchez to St. Louis to settle the matter. Oh, it was also very exciting. My father let me ride in the pilot house. Both ships were identical in design, and both took fuel barges in tow so they wouldn't have to stop to reload more firewood. Well, so who won? Amanda asked. Grace's face broke into a beaming smile as she proudly looked at Grant's picture. Who do you think? She said. My father won by a half an hour. Amanda squealed with delight, and then her eyebrow took a devilish turn. Sounds like you've got racing in your blood.
Well, I guess you could say that, Grace admitted,
but there's no steamboat racing in my future. I think I have just what you need, what both of us need.
Really?
What?
Why don't you and Mason come over to the house on Sunday, and I'll show you.
While the women schemed, Mason and Thorne prepared a list of every conceivable method to rob a train or bank, along with countermeasures to thwart every attempt. It took an hour or two, but by evening's end, they agreed that every scenario known to man made the list. Thorne set the list down on a side table.
Well, that's it.
Is there any other possibility we haven't thought of? Mason asked.
Well, yeah. Houdini could sweep in and make all the cash and gold disappear.
Yeah, well, not much we could do to stop that, I suppose, Mason smiled. The evening came to a close, and Thorne collected their buggy. Mason helped Amanda climb aboard. Thanks for your help, he said to Thorne.
You'll be fine, Thorne replied.
Thorne flicked the reins on the horse, and the Hickams eased their way down the road as Grace and Mason waved from the front porch. Grace took Mason by the arm and drew him near. What are you doing next Sunday? The next morning, Mason put together a list of possible deputies for the gold run. He sent a telegram to the U.S. Marshal's office in Cheyenne for suggestions. The reply came back the next week. It said, "We plan on 20 deputies and a detail from Fort Russell. Advise that you do the same." Mason recalled the valuable assistance from Fort Custer several months earlier in providing troops for the capture of Black Wolf. He contacted the post commander and requested 20 troops to help escort the gold train from Warren to Mile City and back. He estimated the detail would be needed for no more than a few days, sometime during the month of March. The commander agreed, insisting that the post be reimbursed for their time away from regular duties. To fill the need for temporary U.S. deputy marshals, Mason placed a discreet ad in the local newspaper, asking for any veterans from the Spanish-American War to serve as paid guards for 1 week in March. Details were avoided to prevent any unnecessary attention to the real purpose of these recruits. The response was surprising. A line of over 100 able men stood outside the federal office building in the snow to interview for the job. Mason concluded that the brutal winter forced the layoff of many workers throughout the county who needed employment of any kind, hazardous or not. Mason thinned the candidates to the most promising 20 on the basis of military record, physical fitness, and marksmanship with a pistol and rifle. The selected 20 were told to await further instructions around the 1st of March. Mason satisfied himself that now he had the manpower he needed, but he still lacked one. I'd sleep a lot better if I knew that Thorne was going to be on that train with me, he pondered.